You ready?
Yes, we were discussing education.
Yes.
Good morning. This is the April 7th. This is the Education Subcommittee for the Joint Ways and Means. Today we have a public hearing on...
What are we under?
And I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 5024. And this is the Higher Education Coordinating Commission.
So what day is this one?
And if anybody calls it the heck today, you can give $10 to the college fund for opportunity grants. Doug will take your $10 whenever you say that, and he'll make sure it gets good use.
Yep.
Okay, Mr.
Very good use.
Mr. Cannon, and I know you're the biggest. You better bring out your money now.
Yikes. Madam Chair, members, there should be one attachment other than the agenda under today's, and I believe that's what they're working through today. I think Ben is going to start with a couple slides in response to Senator Monroe's questions, and then today will be workforce, and then starting tomorrow we'll be transitioning into public universities and spending, I think, 4 days total or so on the public university side of HEC.
So this is Mr. Cannon's last day?
I don't think so.
Oh. I tried.
Not so fast. Thanks, Doug. Madam Co-Chair, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission.
Yeah, just get used to say it. Yeah.
First off, just a note in appreciation for the time that you took and attention you showed at the public comment yesterday. I found the student testimony extraordinarily compelling, all the testimony, but the stories of the students. I think that so much of what you and we heard about the rising costs that students are facing, rising challenges, help illustrate why the commission's recommendations to you around budget do focus on improving affordability through, in particular, investments in the students who are least able to pay, and through our need-based aid program, and also in institutional investments that can help to reduce the institutional need for tuition increases. Speaking of which, Senator Monroe last week, I think as we were launching the community college section of our presentation, asked essentially what the state investment would have to be in order to restore 2007 levels of funding and support. And there are a variety of ways of looking at that, and this is a sort of narrow way, and I think we have additional work still to do to deepen this analysis. But what we've done here is look really just at tuition and look at the tuition at community colleges between 2007 and the current year. The black bar here is what tuition would be if it rose only at the pace of inflation, CPI inflation. So it was $3,127 dollars for a full-time community college student in 2007 and 8, and if it rose at CPI, it would be at about $3,600. And the green bar is the actual community college tuition, so you can see what has occurred in that same time period as a result largely of diminishing state resources and the need for institutions to continue to try to provide a level of service to students. So if we take this data and we ask, well, what state investment would be required in order to have maintained tuition levels at inflation, essentially, at the level of this black bar? We come up with a figure of, and I'll just cut to the bottom here, it sort of walks through the steps, but we come up with a figure of $603 million, about $61.5 million a year, more than we have in our current 2013-15 budgets, in order to get to that sort of black bar conceptually, right? That's the cost. About $123 million a biennium is the cost of displacing or replacing the tuition increases that colleges have been required to charge as a result of declining state investment. I want to be really clear. Actually, this is not 2007 levels of funding. This would be from an institutional standpoint. If you were to add $123 million and they were to reduce tuition to 2007 levels plus inflation, that would mean no, under this analysis, no new revenue for, or no additional revenue for institutions. So it would be essentially 2013-15 levels of support for students, 2013-15 levels of programming. Obviously, I think if you were to get to this level, our expectation and your expectation would not be that they would reduce tuition down to, you know, knock 25% off tuition. Perhaps it would be that they would moderate tuition increases or flatten tuition, but it would produce additional revenues that, in that case, would produce additional revenues that would support investing in students and student success. So one analysis, I think there's more to do to deepen this, including, as the senator noted, sort of putting this against enrollment, which has really climbed over this time period, but also then started to tail off at community colleges in particular. We're looking at this for universities, and then there's clearly the larger question of adequacy as we attempt to get on a path towards our 40-40-20 goals. But here's a start, and more to come, because I know this analysis is important.
And Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
What this says is that we have to support community colleges to a level that will allow them to not increase tuition, probably for several biennia, and to allow what's happened to kind of equalize again. Because it's taken us a while to dig this hole. It'll take us a while to get out of it.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Any other? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been biting my tongue because I know I'm going to get in trouble for this. I agree completely with everything that is said, but I think there probably needs to be some work done on managing expectations for students also. I heard some really good testimony yesterday, and I heard some concerning testimony yesterday. I heard, and I think students need to be reminded, at least what my perception, I've only lived in Oregon 31 years. I had a number of kids go through community college. Yeah, I'm new. It was an Oregon Trail story. Well, actually, it was, but it was the modern day Oregon Trail. But I digress, right?
Yeah.
You know, in my family's situation, I advise my kids get their AA degree while they could stay at home, get as many dual credits in high school as they could,
yep,
so that they could advance. And so I was always under the impression upon moving to Oregon that community colleges were set for that, a local, reasonably priced alternative for families, for students, so they could stay at home and they could have the family support and whatnot. I heard some sad situations there where there were single mom households and not a lot of the family support. I want to ask where the dad is, if there is a father. And, you know, I mean, there's a parental responsibility there, whether they're in the home or not. I know I'm getting into something totally different, but not really. I heard some comments from students yesterday that were asking us to fill gaps that I don't think we're responsible for. It's some family responsibility there. Again, having said that, I agree with a lot of what I heard yesterday, but I did want to balance it out with a personal perspective.
You know, I hear this a lot. When I carried nutrition bills last session, I heard some members say, well, that's a parental responsibility. And I hear this parental responsibility, and I don't disagree with you, except we have to deal with reality where we find it. And the reality is that there are single-parent family homes where the dad doesn't exist or has left or whatever. And do we want those kids to have an opportunity to move out of that poverty? I think we do. And so we have to deal with the way things are, not the way things ought to be.
Yes, Representative Huffman.
Absolutely. And another comment I heard yesterday from a few of the students made it sound like that it was a constitutional right to a free college education. That was the innuendo under it, and I wanted to speak up and say, not quite. You know, help, absolutely. Want to be here to help you because an educated workforce is a good workforce, blah, blah, blah. But, okay, thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome. And it didn't even cost you $10 today.
Ben really needed to hear that little dialogue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll move forward. We have a full set of slides and information for you today. You know, before we began the portion of this presentation that was focused specifically on community colleges, we had a day focused on transitions, and those included transitions from K-12 to community college, from college to university. We talked a little about the work that colleges and others do in GED preparation and testing in ESL and in adult basic skills to help on-ramp students to higher education and ultimately to the workforce. And that's really the focus of today's presentation. So I'm going to invite Lisa and Karen to join me. This is really a partnership that the Higher Education Coordinating Commission.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Undertakes with the Department of Employment to help channel many federal investments as well as some state investments in workforce training and development in order to ensure that more Oregonians have access to jobs and careers. And so we'll talk about some work, and principally Lisa will talk about work that you will see within the Higher Education Coordinating Commission's budget. It is work that is done very much in conjunction with the Department of Employment. We'll talk about that. And it is work that is in the spirit of transitions for Oregonians from the workforce into training and skills, skilling up, and as well as transitions, most importantly, into jobs. And so with that, we'll jump right in. I'm going to load up the other presentation if it's...
And the committee knows why I'm asking people to not use the acronyms. People do watch us. And lots of people don't know what this acronym is or that acronym, you know. So it really does help our public. And as Ben brings up this great picture, it looks like that might be Neatarts Bay. And is that in your...
That's in my district.
Well, let's put it this way.
No, lighthouse right there, though. It's a little farther down.
Yeah, okay. But does it look like Neatarts?
It does look a little bit like Neatarts, yeah.
Okay.
Could very well be.
So I'm just going to kick off with a funding slide and then turn it over to Lisa to introduce herself and take it away. But essentially, this is the comprehensive view of the budget that we're discussing today. It is primarily a federal funds budget, and in the 2013-15 legislatively approved budget, it's about $117 million. That does include some general fund, but less than $10 million. For 2015-17, it carries forward. It includes that sort of base funding of federal funds, other funds, and there's actually a missing indication of continued general fund in that $119 million. So that's a mistake from this slide. My apologies. And then there's a proposal that will describe two POPs, 201 and 202, for an additional $21 million to support employment programs, bringing the total proposed in the GRB to $136.3 million. And with that, I'll turn it over to Lisa.
Good morning, Co-Chair Comp and Co-Chair Monroe and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Neisenfeld. I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department. I wanted to talk a little bit this morning about how the workforce system is organized, because we get that question all the time, not just from legislators, but from the public and others, and I know it's quite confusing. So we'll try and see if we can make sense of that. But starting with the goals of the system overall, and the goals are both in terms of Oregonians, that they have the skills to succeed in our economy, but also the businesses have the workers they need to succeed, because we need to have those businesses in place to provide the jobs. And then finally, that the workforce system itself is aligned, integrated, efficient, and effective, making the best use of every dollar we've got. So how do we figure out how to do that is a huge question in the way that we're organized. But it's a challenge in every state, not just this state. As we have talked around the state, and as a former economic development professional, I can say that the first issue in economic development is workforce. Will I have the workers to succeed and let my business grow? And it's the second issue, and it's the third issue. It's really the basis of what will provide growth in our state, those skilled workers. So within state government, there are a number of agencies that have roles in workforce development, and I hope that I don't get the $10 penalty for the acronyms on the slides.
I sound tougher than I am.
So we have the Oregon Employment Department. We provide business services. That's principally within the WorkSource system. We do about 70% of the staffing and costs of WorkSource. But WorkSource is a partnership. We have 37 centers throughout the state. I say that confidently. It could be 39, but somewhere in that range. We partner with local workforce investment boards, which are chartered throughout the state. Currently, we have 7. We're breaking up 2 of those this year and forming 4 new ones. So the new workforce investment boards will be the North Coast, South Coast, Central Oregon, and Eastern Oregon. Those were all formerly one big region, so they weren't local at all. So we're hoping that that system works out a little bit better and that we have a better local voice to be our partners at that local level. We also, of course, administer the unemployment insurance system, and we have a substantial research capability which brings you your labor market information, unemployment information, and that type of thing. We have, in the last year, formed an interagency unit with the Community College and Workforce Development Department, and that unit is headed by Karen Hummelbaugh, who will speak shortly. We call it the PIE, Policy, Innovation, and Evaluation. It includes both Employment Department and Community College and Workforce Development staff, so that we've been able to essentially double our reach in administering federal programs, as well as doing planning on new programs, apprenticeship, and things like that. And that project is working very well for us to have that interagency group there. Other actors in workforce development are, of course, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, with both universities, community colleges, and various types of aid. BOLI, Bureau of Labor and Industries, in its apprenticeship programs. We're working very closely with them to try and establish new apprenticeships throughout the state in occupations that were not formerly apprenticeable. So that's a big push on our part, as well as the U.S. Department of Labor. The Department of Human Services has 2 major programs involved in workforce development, the first being the self-sufficiency programs, the programs getting people back to work, and the second being vocational rehabilitation. And we work closely with them to try and coordinate those resources. And finally, the Commission for the Blind does workforce readiness and placement on a much smaller scale, but then integrating all of these integrate into the local systems. The workforce system is overseen by the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. Those members appointed by the governor were the majority of private sector members. They hold the system accountable for results. They're currently reorganizing what those results will look like. We've had a grant from the federal government to take a better look at our outcomes and try and hold the state system and the local systems more accountable for those results. So we're right now retooling our IT systems to make that happen. We recommend policy to the governor and then give feedback to the state agencies and the local workforce boards. That organization is staffed by our interagency department, the PIE. Now, I know this is going to get more challenging, but what we have here are the menu of everybody who is involved more or less in workforce development. And of course, the biggest group involved in workforce development any place is business. They do more in-house training than any of us will ever do outside, although in recent years that's declined somewhat. But all these organizations on the left you'll see have some involvement, organizations in the center, the education system, and then on the right-hand side, state agencies and local agencies. Now, what's going to happen is we're going to talk about different segments of the workforce development challenge, the populations that we deal with, and then we're going to highlight which of these various entities are involved in that. And, of course, it's not perfect. We applied the 80-20 rule. So if 80% of the time it's true, then it's going to be true today. So we're looking at a spectrum of individuals served by the workforce system. And I'd like to point out that we can't operate our economy very effectively if we don't address each and every one of these segments. But they're addressed in some substantially different ways throughout the state. So we're going to start with people with very low skills and multiple barriers. Those are the people who have very complex challenges in getting back to work. It's not just the lack of a skill or a diploma. It's that they have childcare issues, transportation issues, adjudication issues, many different things that are challenging it to get them into the workforce. And so that connection to community resources is a huge issue for this population. And the slide here shows that the ones that are highlighted in green and black are the organizations that principally serve this population. And I'd like to, again, really highlight community-based organizations, because without their support, these workforce organizations and education organizations can't get people through the system. So whether it's a person in an abusive situation or someone who has very small children and needs to find daycare or other types of community support, that is paramount in getting them through. The next cohort is entry-level individuals and youth. Typically, these individuals have little to no work experience. High school students are the most often occurring in this group, but many of them are disconnected youth, youth who have not been in high school for a while. They've dropped out. Some new entrants to the workforce in terms of immigrants, and of course we also include here youth with disabilities. The strategies in working with these young people and immigrants is usually starts with getting them their high school diploma, if at all possible, if not a GED. CTE is extremely important in this group of kids, both in school and out of school. And then finally, another hugely important activity here is work experience, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. So we have, in this one, business begins to be involved in this with this cohort by providing internships and summer jobs, things like that, hugely important, and we have some great models for that in the state. Again, community colleges, school districts, alternative schools, and the ESDs involved in the education cohort, and pretty much the full array of state agencies. We didn't highlight Commission for the Blind here because they have a small cohort of youth, but principally their work is with adults. The underemployed, we all know them. They're people who never recovered from the recession, who, like my sister, had a professional job and are now working clerical work, doing things that are not their desired job or they're not full-time. But they're trying to keep a toehold on in the economy just to survive. Or they're young people who have graduated from college, whether it's community college or university, and they're waiting. Many of us did that also before we could get our first jobs in the economy. And there are a lot of strategies for this group. On-the-job training to complete their skill set, job placement activities, again, CTE, very important. In this case, CTE tends to be with the community colleges, partnerships with the staffing industry, where they can help people get jobs long enough to survive, but then move on to something better. So many, many different activities here. And you'll see probably the most at any one time of organizations that get involved in this. So we don't tend to have involvement from the K-12 system and private universities, but pretty much everyone else, including private career schools, community colleges, and every state agency that's involved. The next cohort is people that are looking to get middle skill jobs or technical jobs. And this is where we hear the most need from local businesses. Now, you have to remember they're talking to us, not to Ben. So it's all relative. But we're talking about journeymen, tradespeople in apprenticeable occupations, healthcare technicians, a whole variety of technicians, occupations that typically require two-year degrees or an apprenticeship, but some kind of credentialing is necessary. Once more, I'd like to emphasize the importance of career and technical education here, and it's particularly important here in its alignment with high schools because we can complete them faster if we have aligned programs where people can get some of that credit in high school or some of that credit on the job. So looking at ways to do that. And another thing that's not on this slide that should be is that we'll be taking a renewed look along with our education partners at the transferability of military credentials, trying to accredit that better within our system. Other states have done some great work there that we'll be stealing. So in the middle 40, technical skills, again, you will see the private sector side largely involved. Education side, except for the K-12 system, and less involvement here of community-based organizations. These people tend to be a little more well-launched on their careers, so they're a little less needy than we saw before. The next cohort, professional and the upper 40, and that would be the upper in the 20, I'll say it right, 40-40-20 scheme. These jobs typically require a bachelor's degree or higher, and they are listed on many examples on the left. They typically require a college education, but which can also be sometimes accrued through distance learning or some combination thereof. And so you're beginning to see a smaller number of people. At the higher skills we get, the smaller number of organizations involved. Community college, hugely important here, particularly in that first two-year transferability program. I'd like to point out that when we've talked around the state to companies, and I'll talk about it more in a minute, it's these four-year degreed jobs that are going begging in rural parts of Oregon. And that's been kind of a surprise to many of us. That we've got to pay more attention on these jobs in those parts of the state. The last group are the super skilled. I like to talk about astrophysicists, but they're also innovation professionals, people who have a very high degree of skills, and without them, typically, you don't get to have a semiconductor laser company if you don't have those key players or if you don't have those innovators. So these jobs create other jobs and help us have more entrepreneurial environment. Again, the panoply of organizations shrinks even more. So businesses are involved, staffing agencies to the extent they're recruiting out of state for talent. Business Oregon is highly concerned at this level to make sure we've got those entrepreneurs and others and the private colleges and universities. So I hope that sort of explains our system and where each of us gets involved. And knowing that, of course, it's always shifting. So we'll keep you posted. The things that are causing us to look at workforce issues a little differently, of course, are the retirement of the baby boom. I at least hope to retire in the next, 5 or 10 years. And the baby boom will be taking with it experience in most of the middle and higher skilled jobs in the state. And we're already seeing this happen in state government and every other employer out there. So it's a serious issue. That We've also seen an increased demand for skills based on technology, so that was, those needs were going up anyway without the retirement of the baby boom. We're also seeing young people working. About 25% of them are graduating from high school and or college without any work experience. And that means that they're showing up not quite understanding that a note from mom is not sufficient to get you off work that day. You know, it's just things you learn, work ethic, things like that, that you learn either in your family or by working itself. And it's, those are things that are difficult to teach in a classroom because they go in one ear and out the other. We're also finally seeing decreased tenure in a job. So the National Association of Manufacturers has surveyed their members about their entry-level occupations, and the average tenure in those jobs in the companies, not promoted within, but in the company itself, is about 4 years. And with tenures that short, those companies are less and less willing to invest in training. And that's become a big problem. So in the past, of where we saw companies would send people to college and do things like that, they're not willing to make those investments like they were. You know, we've seen for decades companies decline to train machinists like they used to. Our machinist apprenticeship programs have gone into disuse because the first moment Boeing was hiring, they would steal them all, and the small companies would be left having to train people over and over again and wouldn't be able to keep up competitively. The answer is not to do training. But we do have a serious challenge here in that private sector participation in the system. Last year, we went around the state and talked with about 700, a little over 700 individuals throughout Oregon, companies, community organizations, educators, community colleges, all kinds of people, about looking at what kinds of employment and workforce services were needed in those communities in the next few years. One of our questions was the employment department has essentially done the same thing for 80 years, unemployment insurance and job match, and is that adequate any longer? And in fact, it turned out the job match by itself is no longer adequate, which is why our partnership with community colleges and workforce development is so important. Because just people are not coming out of one job and able to go straight into a new one. They are coming out of one job and they need some sort of assistance or training in order to land that next job. What we heard from employers are not going to surprise you, that people need more basic skills.
Lisa, just a second. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kump. I just had a question. Are you going to be providing a slide that shows us where within the state these jobs or skills are needed so we can get a sense of where they are located?
Co-Chair Kump, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Taylor, I'm sorry I did not bring that slide today, mm-hmm. but I can provide you with, we have done a substantial amount of research.
Right.
But research is a bold look in the rearview mirror. Right, we're extrapolating based on what happened in the past and mm-hmm. factoring in some things that we know. We have to temper that research by talking to local industry and make sure that those trends are going to continue as we speculate they're going to continue. So mm-hmm. research is sort of half the story, but I would mm-hmm. be pleased to provide you and members of the committee with that research.
Follow up. Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair Kump. The, and some of the other committees I serve, you know, we hear a lot about people in certain parts of the states where they can't find a job and things like that. And I know you work are trying to address that very issue all the time, I'm sure. The and just trying to get a sense of where the situation is of, are these because the schools aren't providing the, what is this gap here, what's happening?
Co-Chair Kump, Co-Chair Monroe, and Representative Taylor, these are things that we heard statewide, mm-hmm. and these are things you will hear nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
We probably could have written this before we went around and talked with people, but we wanted to be sure that we weren't hallucinating. We do have, if you want to switch to the next slide, rural areas, we heard something slightly different, and that is that workers hold many jobs in rural areas, so it's not so much about landing a job,
mm-hmm.
it's about a livelihood. And that livelihood might be made up of driving a school bus for the school district, selling firewood and handicrafts. So it's in very rural areas, it's piecing that livelihood together. And that was an opportunity for us to kind of wake up a little bit, that simply going and talking to employers about jobs isn't everything. We mm-hmm. have to also talk about entrepreneurship and self-employment in ways that we've not done before. The other thing we found in those rural areas and places, not always what, and rural is a funny word, but Roseburg, for example, we found them saying that, you know, their young people are leaving in droves, thinking that there are no jobs there, that people have to go away to get their education and they're going to have to stay away to get those jobs. And yet, those teachers, accountants, government workers, all those jobs requiring a four-year degree, but some less, nurses, others, those jobs in places like Roseburg are going begging. So it's a mismatch, and it's a lack of information. In that particular case, we have 24 researchers placed around the state, and we've assigned them to go start to work with high schools to talk about what are the jobs that are going to be available in your area. So young people and teachers and their families are going to begin to have a better understanding of what that data says in their local areas.
Thank you.
Okay. So to summarize, the critical issues are the skills, and the right skills in the right place in the right time, and that's always a trick, and it's always changing. It's a kaleidoscope. We need to scale up that training. That's why we're trying to work in sector strategies. You may have heard us talk about that. That's a way of wholesaling our workforce work. So rather than talking to just Kaiser Permanente about their healthcare issues, we're also talking to Legacy and to Providence and other healthcare providers in the Portland area about what their healthcare needs are. And when I say we, I'm not talking about us, the state. In that case, it would be Work Systems Inc. and the Clackamas County Workforce Investment Board, who are talking to those organizations. They do their sector work together. Other parts of the state are beginning to do that sector work in various levels. Lane County is doing some great work right now with the healthcare industry, and the Marion-Polk Yamhill area is doing some terrific sector work also. And then finally, once more, aligning all of that work, optimizing every dollar that we've got. So this is the end of my part.
So again, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. When the Higher Education Coordinating Commission stepped into the world a year and a half or so ago, we recognized that we, through the responsibility that we have for the community colleges and workforce development department, have a significant role in the efforts that Lisa's describing for workforce training and employment. And we also recognized that this was a shared responsibility. The governor convened a task force comprised of members of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission that met over a series of months to understand how we share the space around workforce development, and in particular, the roles that we both have for helping to fill and produce the middle 40. So there are a number of recommendations that came out of that work of the task force. I'll mention just a few of them. One of them was that we understand this middle 40 broadly, and I've talked about this with you before. We endorse a broad understanding of what counts, and I've listed again here some of the items that we would recommend be understood as valuable to employers, and representing more than a high school diploma, and should be acknowledged as part of the middle 40, and that then begs investment and policy strategies from the state and our local partners to help to produce these kinds of outcomes. A number of other recommendations, a lot of it having to do with shared data and shared sort of policy and investment work on the part of the Department of Employment and CCWD and the Coordinating Commission. We acknowledge in our commission, I think, very much takes the view that higher education is itself, formal higher education, is an important part of the workforce system, including and especially community colleges, and that they touch, as Lisa noted, they touch on that work in a variety of areas, practically at every skill level that Lisa walked through. And I think that's a that's an important reason for the continued sort of role of workforce in an office of community college and workforce development. I think have a shared understanding that skills, many of them, which can be imparted through formal and informal education, are the currency in a new economy. That is really what it is about, and clearly colleges, universities, private career schools, other portions of the education system have a very significant role to play in the development of skills. As well as I think we also have come increasingly to understand and appreciate the role that training that may or may not occur within formal education, may not be credited, can play in improving workforce readiness and outcomes. I'll let you touch on this, Lisa, in terms of some of the priorities of the workforce system for the department.
Well, we're very clear that WorkSource needs to add more value. We have those 37 offices throughout the state. Again, they used to be just job match offices, and we used to focus on a skill called a tool called iMatch Skills. We've realized two things. One is it didn't work very well, and two was that we can't keep up with the private sector, and why should we try to compete with the private sector? Monster.com and other entities out there do that work better than we do. Let's use their tools and help the public learn to use their tools. So we know we have this large step to go with our local partners to improve those WorkSource centers throughout the state. We've got some terrific people, and we need to provide an additional layer of skills to those staff and to look more at the outcomes of that work, not just the activities that went on. The increasing of sector-based training is very important. So you'll see in local areas throughout the state where formerly a local area might have funded cosmetology training, that will likely no longer be the case, and that's just an example. Where they're looking more at sector work. So if one of the sectors they're looking at in their area is transportation and distribution, then truck driving will undoubtedly see more training. So focusing on those sectors, trying to hook up that training with what's going on in that local economy and the local economic development programs and regional solutions is key, again, to making every dollar count. We're retooling the unemployment insurance processes to make them more efficient and lean. The bearing that has on the workforce system is that that's the way that people can survive between jobs frequently. We're also planning, we're not planning a recession, but we're planning for a recession. And what that means is I've been in the system 30-something years, and every time there's a recession, we're just stunned. And it's like a flood, some natural disaster. We need to have a planned response so that we know how to upscale the people in the WorkSource centers. We have a plan to not make the wait times on the telephones 2 hours long in the unemployment insurance call centers, so that we're ready to change our activities for a recession. We also, in that same vein, have to be ready when that recession is over to switch back to a growth economy. An example I'll use there is that our WorkSource centers right now are still kind of reeling from the last recession, and so they're sitting in the office for the most part waiting to see who walks in the door. Well, no, we need to have people out working with community organizations and others, finding people who need to get back into the workforce, working more closely with DHS and other partners. So we have to be able to modulate between economies, and that's not something that the system has done well. So we have, and part of that also in planning for those recessions, is knowing that the number of people who want to go to school is going to skyrocket. And so how do we work with our partners to accommodate that as well? So So you'll be hearing back from us in probably next year of how we want to model that and maybe put some money aside to make that happen, because we know they do happen.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for this information. I have two questions. The first one is because when you mentioned 37 again, so why is there an uncertainty about whether it's 37 or 39? That's my first question. So you can answer that first if you want, or I'll ask you both at the same time.
Representative Co-Chair Kamp, Co-Chair Monroe, and Representative Smith Warner, it's my feeble brain. We have some offices that have just one person in them, and whether we consider them a full-time center in some counts, because they'll be in someone else's office.
Gotcha. So it depends on how you count.
Yeah, and my staff is very frustrated on my inability to remember which number it is. So I apologize.
Okay, that's quite all right. I didn't know if that was part of the shifting, or because you talked about the restructuring of the boards, I thought maybe that had something to do with it as well, and some of them have transitioned, some of them hadn't, et cetera.
There's a new federal act, which Karen will talk about more, called the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, replacing the Workforce Investment Act of 1998. And it puts more control in the hands of the local workforce boards to decide where those centers should be. And of course, that has to happen in conversation with us, because we control a substantial amount of those resources. So over the next several years, there may be a few less, but we don't have a plan for that at this time.
Okay, thank you. And my second question, thank you, Madam Chair. When you talked a little bit about shifting away from the iSkills and to the iMatch, thank you. Has that shift happened? Are you no longer doing iMatch? And, I mean, because to me it makes a lot of sense, the idea of Indeed utilizing Monster.com or whatever it is, to have people come in and help them with this service that already exists, getting their skills into the right order, and then just being able to apply that, as opposed to having kind of our artificial layer of something on top. So,
Co-Chairs Kamp and Monroe and Representative Smith Warner, we have taken away the public-facing parts of iMatch Skills, so we're no longer having people spend a couple of hours enrolling themselves in that in order to participate in WorkSource. We do have to maintain the parts of it that enroll people in the system, because it was a bigger program than just matching people to jobs. I would say our rollout of training people is still incomplete, but we're working on it.
I have a follow-up with Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lisa, wasn't it iMatch that we had a retreat and several OWIB meetings where people were complaining about the complexity and it was just kind of maybe an outmoded, or was that, am I thinking of something else?
Co-Chairs Kamp and Monroe and Representative Huffman, you're probably correct. It was about a 14-year-old program conceived and built in the IT department of the Oregon Employment Department. It didn't differentiate between people's skills. So, for example, if you took iMatch Skills, I took it once, have you ever done carpentry? Oh, yes, church work project in Mexico in 1968. Check. Have you ever done sewing? Oh, yes, I'm a quilter. Check. You know, it amassed your skills, but it didn't differentiate whether you could do them in a job. So it didn't work. I mean, it was misleading and frustrating for people. And when I went to Congresswoman Bonamici had a session for veterans one day at Portland Community College, and I heard them complaining that they had to do the real job boards, Monster, Indeed, and others in their areas of expertise, and iMatch in order to receive their unemployment insurance. That just sounded crazy to me. So, and then further looking into it with staff, there are still staff who are very upset that we're not doing this, but for the most part, people are happy that they're not spending their time in the care and feeding of a computer program, they're rather spending their time with customers, and that was our intention.
Senator Roblin?
Yeah, two things. One, 50 years ago when I was getting out of high school and I left one job, a little over 50 years ago, close to that. So I went down to the workforce group in Port Angeles, Washington, and they gave me all these tests to see what I could do. And I've always wondered if they still do. I had to move washers from one deal to another really quickly, and they gave all the stuff. And they said at the end of it, don't be a watchmaker, which I knew I wasn't going to be anyway. But it was really an interesting kind of conversation with myself about what different kinds of skills were. And when I was high school principal, we got into a program for a while where we started talking to kids about Me Incorporated, that they really needed to develop who they were and what their skills were, and they needed to know them and be able to express what they could do and be able to show it. And that with the way the world was shaping up, they weren't going to hold the same job for a long period of time. So whenever they were in a job, their best thing they could do for themselves was to use every advantage that company had in helping them get another skill, and then recording that skill so that they could actually show that they do it. Do we do that with these people when they come in, to start helping them develop their knowledge of themselves and to retrospectively look at themselves as to what their skills are and what they aren't, so that at some point they develop the ability to let people know specifically what they can do and how they know they can do that?
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe and Senator Roblin, we have a spotty record in that, frankly. The test you took decades ago was called the GATB.
It was, that's right.
And I'm that old, too. Over the years, various tests have been thrown out by the courts as being normed inappropriately. And so we're allowed to use only tests that have been nationally normed. I spent the last 12 years working in the state of Washington, and our little joke about Oregon is it's the state that tests. because you'd come in, and you would have to take hours of tests. Sorry, Karen. and some people don't want that. Some people say, I need help with my resume, and that's all I want, enough already with the tests. So we're trying to find that flexible middle. So yes, we do have a lot of tools available, and there are a lot of really interesting new tools coming on the market that we'd like to be able to invest in. Things where instead of doing a two-hour test on temperament, you look at some pictures, and it takes 10 minutes to do what a test took a few years ago. So we do have a lot of tests. We're trying to use them more discriminately than we have in the past.
Okay, thanks.
I have a quick question, Lisa, before we move on. As you talk about the number 37, at one session I served on the Veterans Committee, and we now have veteran service officers that work in all parts of Oregon to help with veterans get jobs. Did you work with them, or are they kind of their own separate unit, or how does that function?
Co-Chair Comp and Co-Chair Monroe, unfortunately, there is connection in the individual communities between those individuals. So the Department of Labor has recently changed our scheme of things so that we only have two, I can't tell you what the acronym stands for, I apologize, they're called leavers, but those are the people who deal with all veterans looking for employment. But we have a larger number in most medium to large size centers of veterans reps who deal with veterans with disabilities. And they're only allowed to deal with veterans with disabilities. Now, in the most recent military actions, most of the veterans do have disabilities, unfortunately. So it's not as quite as difficult as it sounds. In those individual communities, those veteran communities hook up very tightly, is what I'm told. At a state level, not so much.
Okay, thank you.
So, co-chairs, members of the committee, this slide illustrates some of what's possible by pulling together data that the Department of Employment develops related to job openings and projections for job openings, as well as data that our offices, the Coordinating Commission's offices, keeps regarding the production of certificates and degrees. There are a lot of caveats around this slide. We're not ready to take what this slide appears to show and turn it into action steps. And I won't get into what those caveats are, but let me just note here, sort of asterisk, that this is an early analysis and really meant to illustrate what's possible by working together between our respective agencies. And essentially the green and black bars, as you've probably noted, relate our production projection, so how many certificates and degrees we expect to produce in Oregon over the next 5 years, against projected job openings, and that's the Department of Employment data, by education level, at each of those education levels, and you can begin to try to understand where there may be a match or a mismatch between what our education system is producing and what our employers require. Again, caveats. Lisa mentioned the one about the using the rearview mirror to project going forward. So we're still at a sort of early phase of this. Obviously, you know, if you were to rely on this, you would say we're vastly underproducing certificates. We appear to be overproducing associate's degrees and advanced degrees. Again, I think there's some noise in here that we're still working out. Although this the message around the certificates is one that we continually hear from employers, and it reflects the emphasis that this legislature has had, as well as our agencies, on CTE in particular.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Comp. So, Ben, of course, anytime I see something, this is 173 and 171%. But for the advanced, can you just talk a little bit about, because we've heard repeatedly that we don't have enough people at the higher end, and so what are those? Masters in teaching kind of things, or are those, what kind of degrees do you think those are?
Representative Taylor, co-chairs, the included within the advanced category are professional and graduate degrees above the level of a bachelor's degree, and that certainly does include masters in teaching, masters in social work, as well as, you know, masters in business administration, the whole suite of advanced degrees. When the black bar and that mismatch reflects the employment department's sort of projection of where job openings will be, it would appear based on this snapshot that the state is producing more advanced degrees than employers require. Now, we could speculate on sort of some of the potential reasons for that, some of the potential advantages to Oregonians for seeking those advanced degrees, notwithstanding what appears to be fewer job openings that include that as their minimum threshold. And I would just again note that we're still working on this and are not ready as a commission to take this data and say, for example, that we ought to be diminishing or lessening the state's emphasis on advanced the production of advanced degrees. But this is the type of data that's possible for us at least to begin that analysis.
Follow up. Thank you, Chair. I just was curious if you happen to have known, is it too many law degrees? Is it too many? If you happen to have known that. But if
no.
you don't, it's fine. That's what I was trying
I
to
don't.
Get at.
So.
Well, you're just trying to say we have enough attorneys.
No. Okay. I'm not saying
Senator Roblin.
Mine was really the same question in a different way, and that is, I think in order for that to make any sense at all, we have to know the subcategories within each of those and what they are. Because we know we don't have enough physicists or people in IT, advanced IT degrees, because we hear that every day, and they're importing them from every place else. On the certificates, I think it would really make a difference as to what kind of certificates are we missing. And so I hope as you go on, because I think this is really important for us, and I think there have been attempts to do things like this to help match the workforce. We don't do it like Germany does, but I think that it would be helpful to inform students who are going to choose where to go. I mean, this would say go get a certificate, so now they go get a certificate and they find out everybody has that certificate. It doesn't help me much. Knowing that information is going to be really important if we're going to try to help people in selecting the kinds of things they want to pursue with the expectation that at the end of the time they will have a job. So,
agreed.
Thanks.
So I think at this point I will step back and invite Kira.
Morning.
Good morning, Co-Chair Comp and Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Hummelbaugh. I am the Workforce Deputy for the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, soon to be the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And I lead the interagency team that Lisa was speaking to you earlier about. So we're going to dig in a little bit deeper into, let me make sure into a couple of things that we've already talked about. The first is the industry sector strategies. And what I want to talk about with this is that this is not just an initiative or some project that we're working on individually as a state or in local communities. This is really a foundational way in which we're approaching the way that we work with businesses on the demand side, and we work with how we can create the supply. So it's how are we going to engage with businesses, students, and job seekers? And it really is based on industry demand. So we recognize that this has to happen at a local level. The needs in Prairie City are not the same as the needs in Portland. So we want to make sure that at the local level, the local boards are convening sector strategies. And this sometimes happens with businesses that may be seen as competitors coming together to talk about what their needs are. There are examples where all manufacturers in a certain area were sending away half-filled trucks, you know, and they were all losing a lot of money on their shipping. So they came together as a sector strategy, and they talked about, here's how we can fill this shipping need we have, for example. Or they'd all come together and say, we're missing this one particular type of technician, and none of us can fill this need, and so they would express that, and then the conveners or the WIBs would talk about what are the trainings that would be needed to make sure that that happens. So this is an approach we're using that is foundational to the work we are doing locally. In addition to having the sector strategies with the industries and meeting those needs, we are also working on talking about targeted populations. So within that framework, our funding really doesn't serve all Oregonians. Clearly, we're serving a portion of Oregonians, but we really want to talk about how do we help bring up all Oregonians so that they have the skills and abilities to thrive and produce and give back to their communities. And so we want to make sure that all of our training is inclusive. And this means that we need to focus on particular populations within local areas. So the local workforce boards are actually talking about what are the target populations in their area. And in different communities, they may be different. We may be talking about veterans that are returning that are targeted populations, youth that we've talked about previously. Perhaps in your community, it's food stamp recipients. So to decide what are the target populations within your local area and combine those and meet up with the demand side with the sectors. So Lisa spoke earlier about the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which is our state workforce investment board, but we do have local workforce investment boards, and these are business-led. They have to have 51% business majority. They are driven by federal law. The Workforce Investment Act requires us to have the local workforce investment boards, but their job is really to convene partners, to gather resources, to talk about how we can supplement just those federal funds and work to match the talent we have in our communities with the demand of the industry business partners. They also have a really key role in helping to innovate and pilot new and innovative approaches. So not just doing things the way we've done them for the last 30 years, but look at what is going to
Representative Smith Warner has a question.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much. You saying that about 51% have to be business representatives. So the other 49 is?
It's a conglomeration of, Co-Chair Monroe and Representative Smith Warner, members of the committee. This is a combination of service providers in the community, community-based organizations. If you recall when Lisa was talking about the different folks who provide, you know, kind of combined towards the workforce system, it's some of those folks. So labor, organized labor, works, the state agency folks, community-based organizations, et cetera.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Lisa mentioned this, but I did think I would show you the map. But it used to be that we had 7 local workforce investment boards. The governor started a conversation with county commissioners last year and really talking about if we're going to be doing this thing that is locally based, how do we best provide that in communities? And we had one local workforce investment area that was all of that central, eastern, northwest, and south coast area combined into one local area. And it was really difficult for those folks to say, here are our targeted sectors, when you're talking about La Grande and Coos Bay and, you know, perhaps Astoria, and they are very different communities. So this is a new map of where we're going to have 9 now local workforce areas so that we can hopefully tackle this at a much closer to local, you know, looking at local economies as possible, so that we can achieve the results I was just talking about. These 4 new boards are in the process of forming and will be up and running by July 1st. This is a picture of what workforce development funding looks like in this state. The green bar is the federal funding. That's a primary mechanism in which we get our funding in the state and through this budget that we're talking about today. You can see that the investment has fallen significantly from the federal government in the, you know, since the mid-2000s. The year of 2009, we actually had a supplement with the Recovery Act, and so we actually received additional funds that year that aren't shown here. Mm-hmm. The black bar is a specific group of funding that is called National Emergency Grants. National Emergency Grants are for particular layoffs or closures that affect 50 or more individuals. We ask for additional money from the federal government because our regular federal dollars wouldn't sort of be able to support the training needs for those folks to transition into their next jobs when we have these mass layoffs or closures. Oregon's been very successful in receiving additional monies for national emergency grants throughout the years, as you can see. And you'll notice that in the 2013 budget is the first investment we received in general funds, approximately $3.3 million in general fund investment. And that was used for a few programs I'll talk about in just a moment, but we have we've had 2 infusions of general fund now, and you see it in the base budget this year in the CSL. So the Federal Workforce Investment Act, which will now be changing into the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act on July 1, actually funds 3 categories of folks: adults, dislocated workers, and youth. Adults are really just anyone who's 18 or over who's here who needs assistance, but we do have a focus on low-income adults. Dislocated workers are people who lose their job to no fault of their own. Generally, they're on unemployment insurance. And youth, that's sort of self-explanatory, but it can be serving in or out-of-school youth, although the new federal law puts a majority focus on out-of-school youth, whereas many of our programs used to be targeting in-school youth. So that's going to be a shift for us in this state. In the system, through all 3 funding streams, we're serving at any one time basically about 250,000 Oregonians in the system, whether they be adult, dislocated worker, or youth. That ebbs and flows with the economy, clearly, but there's still a significant chunk, chunk of the population who we're touching. Now, that could be folks who are enrolled in something as simple as getting assistance in assessing their skills, getting interview training or resume upgrade, or it could be folks that are involved in some sort of more formal training, credentialing, or skills upgrade.
Karen, if you don't have this information, I understand, but how do we compare to the state of Washington?
Co-chair Comp, I do not know that off the top of my head, okay. But we can certainly get you that information. It's readily available.
Okay, thank you. It's just that, I know their population is almost double ours, and it'd be kind of interesting to compare. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, Representative Smith-Warner.
Okay.
You,
thank you,
almost
Madam Chair.
Had to do a happy dance to get my attention.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on that, this actually, again, 2 things. Sorry. And you may have just said this, but as far as services that youth versus adult get, do they get different services because of the I stopped listening for a second, and then I realized, I think she just said that.
Sure. Co-Chair Comp, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Smith-Warner, The services are really tailored to the individual. And so, yes, in many cases, a youth is going to get something different than an adult. An in-school youth, obviously, their next step is going to be a credential of some kind, either their GED or to complete high school. If they're an out-of-school youth, it's possibly doing something like an internship or an on-the-job training. That may also happen with an adult, but it's really going to be tailored to that individual. Youth programs, obviously, the targeted populations have different needs. Dislocated workers have different needs than just low-income adults, because they've had some clear experience in the workforce system or in the work environment already, and so they're able to transition into their next job, whereas youth may need that sort of how do you behave in the work environment kind of thing. So the programs are a little bit different, but we really are trying to tailor it towards the individual.
Toward the specific. Thank you. And can I have one quick follow-up on that? Thank you. My understanding about another significant difference is that dislocated workers are able to access UI funding for retraining and education in a way that your standard unemployed worker is not. Is that correct?
Co-chair Comp, co-chair Monroe, and Representative Smith Warner. It is on the road to correct. So dislocated workers, if you're just a dislocated worker, lost your job to a layoff or closure, no fault of your own, you're sort of in this bucket that we're talking about now in terms of what funding can serve you. There are dislocated workers who lose their jobs due to foreign trade, and they can become, as a group of workers, a company becomes Trade Act certified. That certification and program runs through the Oregon Employment Department. But then you'd individually become eligible as a Trade Act certified worker because of that's how you lost your job, and they are eligible to use their UI claim while they're in training, so training unemployment insurance, and also to access additional funding. So there is a different pot of money for Trade Act certified individuals that comes from the federal government.
Co-chairs Kopp and Monroe and Representative Smith Warner, I'd like to clarify, though, the federal government confuses things a little bit by calling the permission to participate in training instead of looking for a job. The federal mm-hmm. government calls that a program, but it's not a program, it's just permission.
Mm-hmm.
So it is often confusing.
Thank you. That's good. Thank you. All right, so we've talked a little bit about the missed opportunity for youth. They're missing, there's a hyperlink at the bottom I'd really encourage folks to look at. This is a report that the Oregon Employment Department's Research Division provided or did this last year, and it talks about youth in the labor force, and there are a lot of conclusions in there that are pretty startling. If we're not getting our youth into jobs as soon as we were previously, it gives them they don't get that leg up into the labor force. They're not getting the income overall in their lifetime. We have youth accounting for still a third of the unemployed individuals, and so their unemployment rates for youth are higher and disproportionate to the share of overall folks. And so this is a big concern for us all and for the system.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And if you said this and I missed it, I apologize. How do you define youth?
Co-Chair Comp, Co-Chair Monroe, and Representative Springer. Youth for the federal programs is, 16 to 24. Some of our programs serve folks as young as 14.
Follow-up. So it's 24, mm-hmm. something under 24. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes. So the youth workforce development in the state of Oregon here in the system that we're talking about today, we have three programs. The federal funded programs that we just talked about, where we're switching on July 1 to serving 80% of out-of-school youth. We have the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps that runs through this department. That's with other funds, with the amusement device tax. The Oregon Youth Conservation Corps provides both summer and school year programs in all the counties in Oregon. And then we have general funds that have been supporting the National Career Readiness Certificate Program. The last few years, we were talking about some of the skills assessments that are available. The National Career Readiness Certificate Program actually is a way in which students are able to meet the essential skills requirement in reading if they scored a certain level with the National Career Readiness Certificate for some youth, this has been able to allow them to get their high school diploma. So I have a 3-minute video if you have time. I have 4 slides after this.
Thanks.
Go for it.
Okay. Oops. Well, maybe.
we practice this, and I'm not sure how to escape out. Sorry. Oh, sorry. Thank you.
The Oregon Youth Conservation Corps is a program that develops and builds youth through education and workforce development.
They said I would be working with at-risk kids, and I said, what does that mean, at-risk of what? They said, they're at risk of not graduating, at risk of not getting employed. And so most of the youth, they're intelligent, they're bright. They just need a little more support and a little more stability in their life to get some traction.
One of the main pieces of an OICC program is experiential learning and hands-on education.
The work is just work like any other work. You know, you're digging trench, you're moving dirt, but the learning from it is really valuable.
Most of these kids, this is their first work experience, so it's a great opportunity for us to teach them about what the workplace is like and set up those expectations.
They earn money, but they also, they are gaining a valuable skills in how to show up to work on time, how to come prepared, how to be a team player.
They can write a resume. They can interview. They know how to talk.
They are getting an incredible amount of work done. What's really wonderful to see is it's all kinds of work. It's not just in one area.
It's a hard labor, in a way. It's fun. You get to learn new things. It's a pain in the butt, but at the end of the day, you're so proud of yourself.
We also have the Community Stewardship Corps, which is a school-based program where we work with 25 to 30 alternative high schools and middle schools, where part of their education takes place in the classroom and part of it takes place out in the field.
I think it's an incredible organization that gives students opportunities through the year and through the summer to do meaningful work for their community and for the environment. We help them develop the skills and tools necessary to be successful, and we expose them to a wide variety of career paths.
They're earning credits right now. Oregon has a service learning graduation requirement, as well as sort of a career tech graduation requirement, and these kids are meeting those. They also can fulfill their elective credits through the OICC program.
Ever since I've been in OICC, it's kind of brought my mindset to actually wanting to graduate high school now.
What's an estuary?
What I try to do is create the culture where kids understand that high school is not the end. I'm trying to make you into a lifelong learner, because what you might want 20 years from now is not what you want today, and you want to be able to have the skill set to do what you want to do then.
I think it's really going to get me ready for like the type of work that I want to do.
They can give back to the community by building a greenhouse, or by teaching younger students, or by restoring a native stream bank. And those kinds of things, I think, have powerful and indelible impacts that stay with them for their entire life.
The combination of working out in the natural world, of working as a team and connecting to each other, and that confidence that arises in oneself is pretty profound transformation to see.
On paper, it says that I'm not very adept for the learning world. But out here, it's totally different.
I just wanted to share that with you, primarily because it's good to see what these programs do in terms of showing that combination of classroom versus experiential learning. And the OICC program and our other youth programs are doing amazing things with the youth of Oregon. In our state funding, I talked briefly just now about the National Career Readiness Certificate. We also have a piece of that funding is for ACT Certified Work Ready Communities. We have basically that's a way in which ACT says that a community has enough National Career Readiness Certificates that they have a work ready community base. So we actually have three counties in Oregon that have been certified work ready by ACT. They are Union, Clatsop, and Lane counties so far, and the rest are close behind in competing for that. And then we have the Back to Work Oregon program, which we've had now for two biennia. The Back to Work Oregon program is an on-the-job training program, so it's a way in which to get people that experience they need on the job. We have a 50-50 match, so it's the state funds are matched with federal funds, so we get twice as many Oregonians out of that. Each biennia, we get about 1,300 Oregonians who are back to work in terms of getting on-the-job training and then retaining those jobs and contributing to the tax base.
Representative Smith Warner is promising a small question.
I'm so sorry. Co-Chair Comp and Co-Chair Monroe and Representative Smith-Warner, I always get this wrong, actually. It's the American College Testing
it's the ACT folks who do the SAT, like the SAT, it's like the test. So the folks who do the ACT test for when you are in high school, and I apologize for butchering their name, it's those folks who do this. And the test is actually based on tens of thousands of industry looks at jobs to see what skills are needed on the job. And then it's actually, it looks at your skills in terms of your work-based skills versus a more traditional test. Okay. So Lisa mentioned earlier that the critical issues that we have are skills, scaling, training, and alignment. And the final issue we want to talk about is investment. We have a unique opportunity and in that we have some funding that is in the governor's budget that highlights the ability to address some of these training challenges we have. And there are two POPs associated with that funding. The first is the youth employment POP. This would be a package that would provide work experiences for youth through both the local workforce boards and through the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. So both summer and school year programs in all counties and communities in Oregon. It would be this competency-based approach to prepping them up for jobs and for getting work experience so that they can continue on with their career readiness and college. And then package 202 is an incumbent worker training package. It's going to provide strategies to those who are already working but perhaps need the next piece of skilling up or the next credential to be able to move up into their workplace, providing vacancies below them or to be able to contribute better to their employer. It also will, of course, increase their personal individual earnings and their ability to give back in their communities, getting a return on investment. And the rest of the slides we slapped into the appendix for you. So with that, I don't know, Ben, did you want to? I think we're
good. Okay. Any questions for the panel? Thank you. Oh, sorry. Representative Huffman, I thought you were looking up what ACT means.
Oh. No, Karen was close enough for me.
Okay.
For me.
Thank you.
I don't know if it's Karen or Lisa, but Lisa, you mentioned earlier that there were some new apprenticeship programs that are coming online. Can you give us examples of what areas those might be in?
Co-Chair Comp, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Huffman, we are looking at, we're staffing up to do that right now. We're looking at what other states have already done in occupations. For example, the state of Washington has a unit clerk in a hospital as an apprenticeship program. And we would like to steal as much as we possibly can so we don't spend time recreating that wheel. But it will mean getting a consortium of hospitals together in various areas throughout the state to say, yes, this fits our needs. But we're looking at things outside the traditional apprenticeable trades. Largely, we're going to start in manufacturing, but healthcare will also be involved.
Okay.
Someone.
Okay. Another.
Yes,
question?
And then Senator Roblin.
Mandarin language related stuff. I always ask the Mandarin language questions here. Do within workforce, do we have industry coming saying we need? We see this now and on the horizon where we need to have more Mandarin language skills. Do we ever get in our workforce involved in kind of that regional?
Co-Chair Comp and Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Huffman, I have heard that occasionally when I was in the state of Washington related to international trade. Not so much in Oregon where we're somewhat more manufacturing oriented. As far as international goes. And I don't know whether companies don't name it because it feels so far outside of, I mean, they're looking for a little bit more meat and potatoes right now. So we haven't heard that lately, which isn't to say we won't or that others aren't hearing it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin, and then Co-Chair Monroe, if you'll finish us up.
So I just want to say thank you for the entire presentation. And my question goes back to a number of the slides. The first is that we are identifying in our regions the kinds of needs we have, so which youth need to be helped and which whatever. Do we then look at what percentage of those, if we've identified a youth group, Do we identify what percentage of those actually get the training on hand in stuff that we just saw at the end, where they're getting a head start on getting job skills by getting out in the other things? Do we connect the two so that we have an understanding of, are we getting these services that we have this federal money for to meet the needs that the community's identified with respect to their youth who need to have skills mm-hmm. training?
Co-Chair Comp, Co-Chair Monroe, and Senator Roblin, ideally, yes, we are doing that. I think we can definitely do a better job of that. But part of the reason for the change in the local workforce boards and making it more local is to look at that within the community. I think earlier you guys were talking about the numbers of folks, like the kind of the mismatch between skills and the individuals who have certain credentials. And a lot of that has to do with folks migrating in and out and not staying in an area. So we're trying to make sure that we're giving that full menu of choices, particularly to youth, to say these are the careers that will be available in this community, in this state, and these are the skills that you would need to have those, and trying to make that match the best we can. It's not a perfect science, and people have choice still too, and so that makes it challenging, because we can say we have, you know, 50 engineering slots, and even, you know, people may not make that choice.
So I understand that part, but I'm talking about that younger youth that really could take advantage of having had a work experience. So like the two programs we had, mm-hmm. do we identify which kids should get that experience and then try to hone in on getting them that experience? I look at my experience. I lived in a vocational family. I got that work experience mm-hmm. in just about every trade, because my dad knew somebody, and that's what I did every summer forever. And so, but a whole lot of other kids never got that. And those kids whose parents weren't working didn't have a chance. So
Right. Do
we identify that and then get them into these kinds of programs that are giving them that first basic understanding of work, mm-hmm. because that's a really important thing that I think we're missing right now mm-hmm. with a whole lot of our kids.
Absolutely. Co-Chair Comp, Co-Chair Monroe, and Senator Roblin, absolutely, that's true. And yes, we do that. The programs are targeted at disengaged, disadvantaged, or, you know, folks who are not attached to the system in some way. As we talked about before, that first work experience can be where you get your work ethic if you do not get it at home. Or for those of us who, you know, started work really young, doing babysitting and those kinds of things, if those are not part of your experience, you don't see the need or understand what that means. So yes, we do look at those youth for these opportunities in particular.
Okay. Thank you. Co-Chair Monroe, do you want to wrap us up?
I just wanted to tell John, Portland has a Mandarin program. My grandson has been in it since he was three, so he's been studying Mandarin for 8 years. He speaks and reads and writes Mandarin, so sometime when we're going to China, we'll take him along as a translator. There are other school districts, I believe, that are starting some immersion programs in Mandarin. I have a constituent that keeps leaning on me and saying, when are we going to get more Mandarin? The Chinese are coming. Get ready.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Mr. Wilson, what's our agenda tomorrow?
I believe we're starting higher ed with HEC, with Ben and others talking about higher ed generally, or public universities. I'm sorry. And then soon after that, having public universities present on their own.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you, committee. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5024, and we're adjourned.